Hello everyone, your host is Claudia speaking today from Stockholm, and we have a very special guest, Ioana Ciucă, and she is right in Australia. I found a very delightful bio about you, Ioana, and this says the following. A star chaser by trade, Ioana is a Romanian-British researcher working at the forefront of astrophysics, big data, and machine learning with brilliant people and their unquiet and fearless minds at the Australian National University. She cares deeply about education and leveraging high-quality learning resources and mentorship opportunities for students from underrepresented backgrounds. So happy to have you today, Ioana. Now the floor is yours.
Thank you so much for having me here, Claudia. And I'm so excited to talk to you today about my journey to get here. So who I am? I am a 29-year-old right now, researcher in astrophysics primarily. And I work at the Australian National University, as I said in my bio. And during my day-to-day job is I look after many students and I try my best to look after them the proper way. So I have a lot of thoughts on mentorship, and I'm sure we'll get back to it. But I think this is where I want to spend the next 10 years of my life, at the forefront of bringing high-quality scientific projects to kids who really would benefit most from it. And by doing that, we can change the face of academia and our society. And about me, I guess, what can I say more than that? I was inspired when I was a child by the great solar eclipse in 1999. And I was, at the time, I was with my mom and my brother, and we didn't have like solar eclipse goggles. So I actually saw the whole thing reflected into the water, into a water bucket. And that changed my perspective so much, because I was like, oh, you know, even if you don't have the right tools, you can still have that curiosity and that desire to understand the world around you. And that feeling kind of propelled me forwards, and I managed to go to study at the best places in the world, like very good high school in Bucharest. And then I went to the UK, and then I did my PhD at University College London. And then somehow I'm very grateful for the opportunity that I got to come and study here, research here at ANU. And I'm very excited to see what the future brings next.
Thank you. So exciting. Such a young force doing amazing good and showing examples to the entire world. I am curious if you could tell us a little bit more about the mentorship programs and how that experience changed your perspective and yourself in what you do today.
All right. I'll try my best to do justice to the great world of mentorship that I've experienced so far. So there are a few key ideas here. So first of all, I'd like to tell you a bit about the mentorship I've had access to. And then secondly, maybe I can tell you a bit about the mentorship that I want to undertake as a mentor moving forward. So the mentorship I've had access to revolves from many people that supported me in university. I would like to acknowledge Mr. Paul Clark from the University of Durham. He was the person who believed in me and my team, Low Gravity, which you were also a part of. He believed in us and helped us get our project for the European Space Agency. So this is someone that at the time when I was I was not very confident at that time. This is someone that saw our potential and my potential and said, look, you know, I can help you get to the European Space Agency. And we actually went to the European Space Agency and, sent a rocket into space. So, you know, the story of that. So that was like my first proper interaction with a mentor outside of Romania. Inside of Romania, I think most of the people I've interacted with prior to that point were truly extraordinary, and they helped me a lot. So my high school teachers, my physics teacher, my math teacher, my family, of course, and my colleagues and my friends. After that, so after university, I've engaged in three things that were really incredible. The first one was the Data Science for Social Good project that I undertook as part of the Alan Turing Institute and the University of Warwick. So this project was designed by by some really amazing people, that they thought that if you bring people together, like small teams of people who have the right tools in machine learning and also the proper ideas about how to improve society, they can work on small projects, and these projects can help the world. And I was one of the members of this of one of these teams, and it was amazing because I had so much access to, you know, people who worked in social policy, people who worked in for the Alan Turing Institute at the highest levels of knowledge and research, and I also had access to people working in government and other people like me who are also thinking about doing something for the world around us. So just being in that group showed me that it's possible to make a difference even when the problems that we face are very, very difficult. And I would say, so the first one would be, you know, okay, my first mentorship would be the people back home where Romania is. And then my people, the people in university that helped us with the Rexus. Then was this DSSG project. Oh my God, there's so many, Claudia. I can't even. There's just been so many. I just highlighted some of the ones that really changed my perspective. But there are just so many people that helped me along the way, and so many resources that I had access to. You know, I had access to internships during my undergraduate years. I had access to data science fellowships when I was doing my PhD, and now at the ANU, I have access to so many resources by the schools that I'm part of. And all of these things that I have access to, they sort of make me believe that, you know, it's like you receive something and you have to pay it forward. And by receiving these things, I'm learning how to pay it back by looking after students, you know. And now we have this thing in academia, we have to look after their mental health. So I've been looked after properly, because now when I talk to my students, I'm sure I want to listen and be there for them the right way. I'm sorry, I'm digressing so much. It's just such a big question to ask me.
I'm very curious, because hearing more and more often that it's hard to get there, I want you to tell us, how did you get those resources? How did you get access to those internships? Because you are not part of an already set situation, you reach for those.
That's a really good question. So on one side, I worked hard. I'm not going to put this down. Yeah, so I mean, I did my part when I was younger, especially. And now as a postdoc, as a research fellow, lecturer, sort of mixed thing that I am, I actually am not working quite as hard as I used to. But when I was younger, I worked extremely hard because I really wanted to break the limits that I thought were confining me at the time. So working hard, and then resilience. I think that was another quality that I had, or like I'd actually honed through time. And, you know, like in research, you get a lot of failures. Failure is the norm. It's not success. Failure is the norm. And this ability to look at failure as something that teaches you rather than puts you down, I think that is something that I learned the hard way very early on. And it's helped me actually say to myself, okay, I didn't get this opportunity. Let me just try the next one and the next one. So this sort of worldview, I think. So hard work, this worldview that if you don't get this opportunity, there's always another one that you can try, and you should never give up. And the third one, I would have to say, would be a bit of luck, actually. And so I mean, just meeting the right people, like, you know, with hard work and resilience, I think they are quite a strong combo. Of course, I don't want to be naive about it either. So I do think that I was also quite privileged in the sense that, okay, so I wasn't privileged from the very start, but once I got that first opportunity, like a big ball of opportunity to, you know, to go into the UK and have access to RexisBexis. And once that was there, I could leverage that to get other opportunities. So I would build upon the ones that I just got. And that gave me confidence. And the more confident you are, actually, and the more opportunities you have under your belt, the easier it is to take the risk to get the next one. But I was also quite privileged that my parents and my family, they allow me to take crazy risks like that, to do astronomy. Like, I don't think many people have that option. You know, if you think about it, they have to support their families and maybe resort to less risky options to keep them financially stable. And I had a family who said, we don't want that. We just want you to take these risks as much as you can. So in that sense, I was also quite privileged.
That's fantastic. And I like your humbleness, although it's up to each of ourselves to get to success, to be successful. It's not set by political classes. It's not set by the country where we live. It's set by our inner call, inner motivation.
I think inner motivation definitely plays a huge role in that. But I also do think that, I mean, there are barriers. There are systemic barriers that people struggle with, that we have to change that in our societies. And for me, it's like, you know, the access of women to research. I am in a position now where I can leverage my social capital to make a difference by just by being here and doing my job day to day. So those barriers, I think we can tackle them by the power of personal example and what we do with that power, you know.
Right. I'm curious now, because this is a field not very common that we choose as young kids to pursue for our life. Career was just personal interest. How many girls are in this field when you started, and how did that change? Of course, you've been part of so many international groups, and the diversity might be different. But could you share any insights about it?
So when I was starting, as in the first time I fell in love with astronomy, I don't think I recall knowing any Romanian astronomer working inside my field. So I didn't have that immediate mentor. Maybe that was because I was naive and I didn't know where to look, but it wasn't something that I think in our society at the time was quite present, as in, you know, like Romanian astronomy. We didn't have that. So I had to look elsewhere, and then I couldn't find many female astronomers either. So I had to look elsewhere, and I kept going and going, and I found this, you know, I focused on the science, not the people, really. And I think that helped me. But now I have to focus on the people too, because the science cannot be done without the people. And I think I have this crazy quality. I would say not crazy, but I'm not very afraid of many things. So I could just jump in and just get hurt and like bruised and stuff. But I think that I don't want that to happen to other younger people. I want us to have the role models there. And I think that's very important.
With people like you, that I'm sure will happen.
With people like me and my colleagues, I would say, especially my colleagues, and I want to give a huge shout out to the Romanian Science Festival and my dear friend, Sandor Crook, who is in charge of that together with many wonderful people there. And you know, they are doing a brilliant job. They're actually taking mentorship at the next level and bringing it back home to Romania. So I humble down before them. You know, they're amazing.
That's right.
Me in Australia, if I can do anything here, you know, to support kids back home who want to come to study in Australia, I'm very happy to hear from them.
Yeah. Amazing. It would be fantastic to see more and more such events, initiatives. And I want to tell to our listeners that they can find on YouTube one of the discussions you had with him and regarding the festival there. So it's amazing, and it's online. Now that you tell more and more about the university, would you mind sharing with us some examples of projects that you are working on, or what you want to emphasize from what you've been completed over the time more recently in the field of astronomy?
So my primary research domain is galactic archaeology. So in galactic archaeology, we're trying to reconstruct the history of our galaxy, the Milky Way. So just to put things into perspective, the galaxy has around between 100 to 300 billion stars. So this is quite a big galaxy. And all these stars, they're moving on really unique orbits, and they have very unique chemical footprint, like DNAs. They're very unique chemically, each of these stars. And my job is to understand how these properties changed over time and what were the processes that happened early in the history of our Milky Way that shaped the way that we observe the galaxy today. And I work quite heavily on projects related to galactic archaeology. And I think there's a twist here that more and more recently I've started taking inspiration from AI related research, from deep learning, and applying those algorithms to the data sets that we have from astronomy, from galactic archaeology, and using that to extract meaningful information. So we are now in my field, we have entered the era of very big data, and we can no longer just get away by not using deep learning. And it's a slow progress, you know, like knowing how to use these algorithms, getting the domain expertise necessary to know how to apply them and so on. So right now I'm actually working on a project to use generative models, deep normalizing flows, and as of lately, diffusion models, which, by the way, I have to make a segue here, are the ones that are used in the DALI, OpenAI DALI algorithm. If you've seen that one, you just input text and you get a nice image out. It's very funky. So we are using some of the same techniques to apply that to astronomy. And one of the projects I work with is to understand starlight from the star. So I'm trying to model the starlight via a normalizing flow or a diffusion model approach. We're doing this to find unique elements in the stars. So this is one project. Yeah, one project that I'm working on quite a lot at the moment.
I'm so curious to hear the progress of this project. I'm going to follow closely any publications or mentions about the output of this project.
My brilliant mentor and friend, Professor Janssen Teng, he's also here at the ANU, and he's one of the true mentors that I've had, like here in Australia, and actually that in my entire existence. This is someone who has believed in me from the very start. Even I was struggling with, you know, we'll probably come back to this at some point, but, you know, after the pandemic, it was quite hard to go back to work. And he's been there for me and helped me loads. And together with him, we've published this research. Actually, it was his idea. And we did it justice by publishing our results in the ICML 2022. I think it was the last one, the one in Baltimore. We published it in the machine learning for astronomy workshop. So it's available online on their website.
Amazing. Thanks for the reference. When you say big data, what volumes of data do you get for a specific project?
So for the ones that I work with, we're looking at data sets that are of the order of 10 gigabytes, millions and millions of data points, each data point consisting of over 10 dimensions. And in the case of stellar spectra, which describe the starlight that we observe from the star, each of these spectrum, they have around 4,000 dimensions, and we have around a million of those spectra. So you're looking at a data set of a million by 10,000. So it's a lot. It's a huge problem. Not quite like images, but quite a high dimensionality.
And what are the biggest challenges when you get such data set? And what's the source of this data set? Is it something that you produce, you observe, you simulate, or is it provided from some other sources or even open databases?
So most of these data sets that they are observed. So we actually have telescopes that observe this data, or missions like Gaia, like the European Space Agency's flagship Gaia mission. This there's a satellite that's orbiting, and as it's orbiting, it's observing the night sky, and that gives us a lot of information. It's an astrometric mission, so it's giving us information about the sort of the position of the source of the star and how the star is moving. And then we have these big telescopes that give us information about the starlight. So all I've mentioned is all observed data, but of course there are huge simulation data that we also have access to. I just don't work very closely with them. But of course, I want to tell you about the challenge I've encountered with the data. And this is, you know, a challenge both in big data, but also in a newbie when it comes to using deep learning for the big data. So I was trying to, I was trying to model this 10,000 dimensional data set using a generative model. So this generative model, these models have a lot of parameters. They're huge models. They have approximately 1 billion parameters. And I was trying to train the model. So, you know, you have an input, you pass it through the model, you get an output, and you compare the output to the input, and you're like, oh, you know, you're quite similar, but I still want to do some improvement. So you go back and you keep training. That's what I mean by training your data. You have to minimize the difference between what you expect and what you have. And I was trying to train this model on my machine, on my laptop. And the moment I defined the model, and then I tried to load the model in the memory, it failed. It wouldn't let me. So then I tried to train the model on a bigger machine, on a GPU machine, actually. So the GPU could actually load the model. So there was enough memory to load the model. However, when I was trying to train the model, there was just the training task was just too, it's quite hard to describe this without going into the fundamentals of deep learning training, but imagine it is like the training task. He said, you know, you have to have access to around 10 points. And the moment that the model like got access to these 10 points, that data was actually crashing the GPU because it had no more space to hold them. So it could barely hold the model itself. But the moment you started training the injection of the data into the model, it was like, I don't like this. So then I tried to train on a group of GPUs. So 4 GPUs, you know, one machinery that had 4 GPUs. It failed there too. It's just too much for even for 4 GPUs to train. And then I had to go to a cluster of GPUs to actually use groups of 4 GPUs clustered together in a network of groups of GPUs. Finally, that worked. But the whole thing took me 1 year. The scientific project was done in like a few weeks. So this is one particular challenge people like me, astronomers like me are encountering right now. We are not trained in how to deal with such big data and big models yet.
I have 3 questions around this one. What is the resource that you get for GPU? Do you go with a cloud provider or something that the university has, like on premises?
So the cluster of GPUs that I had access to I had access to it via the National Computing Infrastructure of Australia, the NCI. And, you know, they have open calls. You have to submit a proposal that gets into a pool of proposals. And if you get accepted, then you have access to the GPU system and the CPUs. So, yeah, you have to apply for these resources. You don't just get them. It's quite competitive, actually. And my mentor Jansen, he and I and a few other brilliant colleagues of ours, we submitted a big proposal, and it was during that proposal we got it accepted, and I used a small allocation of that proposal to train my models. Yes.
Fantastic to have resources to work with. they make our lives easier. Have a point to add on this one. I'm curious to talk to you in 10 years about this topic and hear about how resources scale and data sets about this field in 10 years. I can't imagine that.
Oh, yeah, we're getting even bigger and bigger data. So we have the LSST now, one of the biggest surveys ever. I can't remember exactly because they keep changing the name, but it's the Large Synoptic Survey for Space and Time. I think that's what it stands for. And we're going to observe over 37 billion objects over a period of 10 years. And, you know, that data set is of the order of terabytes. So it's we're observing one. So imagine that if until now, as astronomers, we primarily just imaged one source, and then we went back to that source a few times across 5 years, whatever. But it wasn't systematic. We didn't do this systematically. We just had a few sources that we reobserved to see how they changed through time. But in the case of LSST, it's like a movie. You're not taking one photo. You're taking a full movie of that source over a 10-year period. So that continuous data stream, it's big. It's bigger than anything we've seen. So at least for my things that are relevant to my field. I think the LSST is posing a huge problem. So we have to have distributed data, all that stuff that I don't know much about, but we have to learn about these things, yeah.
This gets more and more exciting. And the third point around that mentioning is connected to exactly this last part that you mentioned. How does this field evolve and this discipline and domain into some engineering and some machine learning engineering and some infrastructure? How do you see this collaboration being presented as a challenge or as an opportunity, or any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, so here I just want to sort of touch upon briefly on my current position, which is, you know, some I think it's a bit unique, some I think it's a bit natural, but I'm actually working as a joint. I'm working on as a joint, I have a joint position. So until May 2020, we're in 2022 right now. Yes, I keep forgetting that the pandemic has messed my mind. So until May 2022, I was working just in the Research School for Astronomy and Astrophysics. And since May 22, I got a fellowship, the JUBV fellowship, and now I work also in the School of Computing. So I have two schools that I work with. I work half-half. And this is an initiative that my brilliant advisor, professor, another super brilliant advisor that I have. I have many people that look after me. I'm very grateful. Professor Amanda Barnard, it's her brainchild. So the idea is that we are entering an era now where one field cannot bear the challenges of the data that it sees. So in the case of astronomy, we need to actually start looking at intersectionality and bringing experts from the field of, from the School of Computing to help us with our data astronomy projects. So that's one way to think about it. I think the opportunity that this presents is that opportunity for true transdisciplinarity. So, you know, it's like we can't do it on our own anymore. So why should we not collaborate with other fields, with other universities, and do it together? So I think it's a true opportunity. I don't think of it as a big problem. I think it's really helping us to break through these barriers of apparent disjointness. We're not really. Everything is truly connected. So
I love this mindset, more collaboration. And this will only leverage the power of ideation and creativity and what can arise from this.
Yes.
But what happens with this project, or what do you think will happen even in the future when there will be a streaming?
So you mean what are the outputs of the project? What are the people that these projects are helping or opening doors to? Or am I not?
Exactly.
I mean, the honest answer I want to give is that true research never ends. You can always improve on things. So, you know, we have to still maintain a relatively pragmatic attitude. If, you know, we have this data set and we run for example, a big generative model and we get some results, we want to publish that. So we want to give it back to the community. And then hopefully we can do so via an open source approach, which I'm really pro for. I really want the open source more because I think it's the way to move forward. You know, we package our code and we package our, you know, snapshots of our data depending on the copyright rights and stuff. And then we put them on a GitHub repo and I say, this is what we did with this data. This is what we achieved. This is where the publication lies. And then, you know, people all over the world, they have access to that mini package and they can go and improve on the data and they can publish other papers. Say, you know, we applied a new model and we're doing better than you, but it doesn't matter because we serve science, you know, like the goal here is truly, I don't believe the goal is to publish papers. I think the goal is to answer a question that matters and to, by doing so, publish something or just give something back to the community, say, hey, this is as much as I could get. And then the person can take the question and do something better with it if they want to. I don't believe in blinded science. So keep things hidden. I don't believe in that. At least in my field, I'm sure there are other fields where this is highly way more serious, like privacy related stuff. So that's like on the pragmatic aspect, we have to see an end to our projects. But, you know, like for most of the times, what happens to these projects is that we work on them, we work on some project, and then we always want to do something more, but we want to also leverage this to our students. So what happens most often than not, this, our students actually get access to the data and they work on a different project that expands our work. If that's what they want, of course, we just can offer them a sort of an avenue. Hey, this is what you could do with this data. And then they take over. But yeah, I mean, I think it's with my field where it's a very good question. And I think in science in general, we're always trying to refine understanding of nature. So we're always going to go back to very fundamental questions. And it's good to have some history of what people did, and that it's important to be their open source. So I don't know. I mean, with all my projects, I try to package them nicely so I can go back to them at some point.
That's really nice. And well phrased, that one, to keep that history and give to the community, put on for it. It will help us all in the end. But you mentioned here that you try to share these projects with students and involve them and collaborate and create links and connections with different research groups. What is the approach when students from this field have very limited data science understanding or background or practices, skills and knowledge to manipulate such big volumes of data?
So, I mean, it depends on the student, really. So if the student is working as part of my current employer, my current university, they will have access to resources like computing time, and they will have access to courses in machine learning and statistics that they can use to perform their tasks, right? So this is, they have access, at least at ANU, we have that sort of opportunities. If the student is external to my university, or there's a very curious student that doesn't have a GPU and they want to train the model because they want to learn about it, then it gets a bit more complicated, indeed. Because if the resource is not there, you have to come up with in sort of creative ways to tackle that. So I'm very grateful for resources like Google Collaboratory, with external students, because on Google Collaboratory, for example, you get a GPU for one day and you can downscale your data. You can sample from your data. So I have some experience with some startup knowledge. So I like to think about the MVP. It's like the minimum viable product that the student can work with, such that they optimize their knowledge. Because when they apply for university PhDs and so on, they say, I didn't train a GPU, a model on GPU, but hey, I understood how this model works on this CPU because I downscale the data, I downscale the model, and I understand the fundamentals behind it. And then they can go to uni and do whatever they want there. So yeah, I think of MVPs, yes, like what is the skeleton of a project? What is the skeleton of the data that you can use such that you optimize your, I'm speaking as an ML practitioner now, am I? That you can optimize your knowledge. And I do this to myself too. I take a big project and then I start with the basics lately. I've been doing this lately, not always.
So there are resources to prove the MVP. I'm more curious about the perspective of how the academic resources are evolving over time and if there are any data science, machine learning courses or labs, seminars around this field in the astronomical field, discipline or curriculum?
There are a lot of them. So they're starting to become more than they used to be. So I think there are a lot of them because I see a lot of them because I'm also in school, in the School of Computing. So I immediately have access to a lot more than my other colleagues who are not in the School of Computing. So I can name a few. So we have LSST, the one that I mentioned. There's a wonderful person that I know, Dr. Lucian Walkovich, and she actually started in the US training program to know how to handle LSST data products. So this is a two-year program. And during these 2 years, you go to the US six times and you get and you learn from the very best people how to where to store the data, how to download the data, how to apply machine learning techniques to this data, how to use the results from the data to, you know, publish or to outreach with it as well. So that's, you know, like I think the data is informing initiatives like this. And in Australia, we have huge collaborations. You know, we have a group of people here that meet regularly and we discuss as astronomers, okay, have you used this technique? Has it worked for your project? And so on. So in Australia, we also have a big community of people. And, you know, all the big machine learning conferences like ICML, NeurIPS, NeurIPS, all these big, big, big fishes in machine learning, they're starting to have workshops centered on how to apply these methods to science. And, you know, in Eastern Europe, I can't but shout out, huge shout out to the Eastern European Machine Learning School, which is a brilliant initiative by a few very, very incredible human beings. And they're, you know, they're setting up this school every summer to go there and to learn about machine learning and they, you know, and how to apply it to science as well. There are many very smart kids there going there and showing their results. So there's a lot happening, I think, in this scene. I haven't focused primarily on astronomy, but on science, like biochemistry, you know, chemistry, medical research. In the UK, for example, Claudia, there are, you know, there are doctoral training centers now. So the university itself is actually coming up with with PhDs that say, okay, we're going to spend 1 year training you in data science. And then the next 3 years, you can do your biochemistry project using what we've trained you on. And, you know, DeepMind and OpenAI and Meta, they have, oh, sorry, I'm going to stop at some point, but they have like internships and opportunities that actually are sort of targeting science people, science students. So they're like, you know, OpenAI actually has one that's currently enrolling. If there are some listeners of ours that want to join, there's called the OpenAI Residency Program. And these are, you know, people who haven't done AI, but they've done some science and they're very interested in learning more about how to use AI for science. So yeah, it's a lot happening.
I hope that this advice that you shared with our listeners would make things better in research in general and will encourage more people to try this path, try this avenue. Maybe it's for them, maybe it's not, but it's absolutely fascinating to learn more about society, about the world, about nature.
For me, the moment I got a computer when I was younger, that changed my world. I had this romantic view about technology, which as of lately, I'm trying to, you know, realistic about the implications of using technology for nefarious purposes in our society. Let's put it like that. You know, I understand that, but like my original idea was quite romantic. I got this box made of aluminium that allow me to connect to the world and learn about the world. And it's probably going to fail 99% of the times if you start on a ML project. I mean, just this week, I mean, just before I started talking to you, because it's 4 p.m. in Australia right now, 5 p.m., 6 p.m., I was working 8 hours on a model that just fails and fails and fails. And that's okay, because that's how it is. That's literally the journey. You have to be very comfortable with failure. You fail 99% of the time, but then 1% you actually get it right. So that's something amazing. So yeah, I just want to say to our listeners to not be afraid. If they want to do this, there are so many ways to do it. Yeah.
Amazing. I cannot say how privileged I feel to have had this discussion with you today, Ioana. We've covered quite a lot, and I hope this will be just the beginning of what someone can take from here and open so many new doors. But I'm really, really grateful for having you today, Ioana. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Claudia. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and to see you again. And I look forward to being back. Thank you so much. And good luck to everyone listening.
We wish a lot of success with research in all your projects.
Yes, thank you. I wish to minimize the failure. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ioana. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.